We are continuing today with our series with the New Mexico Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'd like now to welcome three attorneys, all of whom are with the Innocence and Justice Project here in New Mexico. Molly Schmidt-Nawara is a criminal defense attorney, and she's vice president of the New Mexico Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. She's an adjunct professor at UNM Law School with the Innocence and Justice Project Seminar. Gordon Ron is a research professor at UNM Law School, and he's supervisor of the Innocence and Justice Project. And Asia Oishi is staff attorney with the project. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
So this is a very interesting topic that we're talking today about today, namely wrongful convictions. We can talk all day and all night about how many people are in prison for things they actually did and whether nonviolent drug offenders should be in prison or should be in prison for as long as they are. And we will talk about that on this program. But there's also a significant number of people who are in prison for crimes they didn't commit at all. And it is your job, and it's really our job as a society, to support you in getting people out of jail who are there. Many people have heard of the Innocence Project, which is a national project. You guys are doing similar work here in New Mexico. What are the causes of wrongful conviction? There's a number of them.
Yes. There are a number of overlapping causes that you find present in wrongful conviction cases. And we know this because we've been able to identify this because over the last basically really 20 years, there have been, there's been breakthroughs in the technology of DNA, and so there have been around 300 DNA exonerations around the country. And so as a result of that, lawyers and social workers, et cetera, have been able to go back and look at those cases and say, where did the system fall apart? Why did the wrongful conviction happen? And among the most common causes are mistaken eyewitness identification. That's probably the most frequent contributing factor in wrongful convictions. Junk science, what we sort of call junk science, where either science that was forensic analysis that was done improperly or actual methodologies that are invalid. So, for example, microscopic hair analysis has been shown to be really scientifically junk, invalid.
Which is amazing because, I mean, many of us, myself included, do watch crime shows, and hair analysis does play a role.
Sure.
And it's sort of like breaking down my sense of reality to say that hair analysis isn't very good science.
I know. I mean, I think that there's a lot of conventional wisdom about things like memory and hair analysis and things like that are just wrong. The scholars and the individuals who work in this area, the lawyers, scholars, scientists, they have to overcome that perception, that sort of conventional wisdom that people cling to. And when I say people, it's not just the general public, it includes the courts. Some of the other causes are things like jailhouse informants, government misconduct, unfortunately bad lawyering on the defense side for various reasons. Those are all things that tend to contribute to a wrongful conviction.
Let's talk about the biggest one, which is eyewitness misidentification. What is the problem going on there? I mean, somebody sees a crime, they report it, or they're questioned when the cops get there, and it turns out, I mean, like, what? Give us a story. Give us an example of eyewitness misidentification.
Well, I think what you see is a lot of the eyewitnesses are experiencing something they never experienced before, often a very traumatic situation, whether it's a victim or a witness who's just in the neighborhood. And what we've learned in the recent years is that our memory actually begins to lose what it saw in just a matter of minutes. And a lot of times our eyewitnesses come forward a day or two later. They call the police and say, I saw this. This is what I saw. Law enforcement brings them in to look at a photo lineup. They get a description. And we see a lot of times that they just pick the wrong person, using what we call relative judgment, which is they pick the person who looks most like the person they saw relative to everybody else in the lineup. Not necessarily from their memory, but just comparing it to everybody else in the lineup.
I saw a harrowing case on TV some years ago where a woman had been brutally raped by a stranger who broke into her apartment, and it was a black guy. She did exactly that. She found somebody in a lineup, said that looked like him, and he went in. He had an alibi, but they didn't believe his alibi, and he went to prison for years and years and years, and finally somehow they found the right guy who did kind of look like him.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, does there not have to be some kind of physical evidence to go along with cases like that?
Well, the reality is, I mean, in the vast majority of criminal cases, in many criminal cases, there really isn't physical evidence. I think that's kind of the CSI myth, you know, that every case is going to have videotape and DNA evidence and fingerprint evidence. And the reality is, in many crimes, really, it's eyewitness testimony. I mean, that's the bulk of the evidence. And so, you know, as a criminal defense lawyer, sure, I'd love it if there had to be physical evidence in every case. But it would be, to be fair to the government, it would be very hard to be able to seek convictions in a lot of cases if that were the burden. And so, you know, I think what we can do as a system, you know, everyone working in the system, what they can try to do is do everything they can to preserve the accuracy of eyewitness testimony and to exclude testimony that is inaccurate for some reason. And that's, I think, what the system doesn't do a great job at this point. And so, unfortunately, you have a lot of inaccurate eyewitness testimony coming into evidence, and it's really powerful evidence. Jury studies show time and time again that when someone gets on the stand and they say, that's the person who did this, I saw this person do it, there is almost no more powerful evidence than that. And so it's tough.
And it's, you know, if you look to your own life, and many of us who have never witnessed major crimes, you say, I'm positive Aunt Lucy was with us at Thanksgiving 2 years ago.
Exactly.
And she wasn't. Mm-hmm. You know, we all know of times where we've made those kinds of mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So are there other issues that come into play when we're talking about eyewitness misidentification? I mean, sometimes I know there have been cases where either the police or the prosecutors come up with their version of reality and, I mean, almost really kind of coach the witness to say what they want them to say so they can get a conviction.
Well, that's one of the things that we have seen over the years in the innocence work is just how that can happen. You know, it's very easy for a detective, somebody with law enforcement who knows who the suspect is, to either intentionally or unintentionally give clues as to which person in the lineup is the person that is their suspect. And you mentioned the stories. We had a case years ago where a detective was showing a photo lineup to a rape victim, and she studied it for several minutes, picked out three people, and the detective says, you're doing great so far, you know, but I need you to pick one of those three. So that's telling her, okay, one of these three is there who they think did this. And she studies it for several more minutes and finally picks who turned out to be our client, you know, the wrong person. And at the outset, the description that she gave of her attacker was long, chocolate, dark brown hair. Well, our client had bright orange hair, and they showed the photo lineup in black and white rather than in color. So she didn't really get to see his hair compared to everybody else. So that does happen. And sometimes it can be unintentional, just, you know, a little movement or something like that from the detective.
So photo lineups don't have to be lineups don't have to be live. They can be photographs?
Well, in fact, in the vast majority of cases, they are photographs now. And it's actually very rare to do a live lineup for lots of reasons. I started out as a public defender in Washington, D.C., and they still did do some live lineups. But it's tough because they have to get what are called. So they'll have a suspect, and then they have to get what are called fillers.
Yeah, 3-4 other guys.
Yeah, or 6-7 guys, whatever. And to find people who are physically enough similar to the description of the suspect, in theory at least, that you're not just, you know, it's not just one of these people is not like the other, you know, type of selection. And so that's really difficult. And so generally now there are photo arrays. The police use photo arrays, what are called, often called six packs, where they'll have, you know, a sheet of six photographs. One's the suspect, and then there are five fillers that are picked from mugshot books or booking photos or things like that. But I think, as Gordon touched on, one of the problems is that, you know, I think what you see in New Mexico and all across the country is there isn't a lot of training for the police about how to really make sure not to taint a eyewitness's memory. And so there may be really benign, you know, sort of motives on the part of the police, but this sort of desire to want to praise the witness if they get the right ID, quote unquote, right ID, you know, subtle, you know, body, nonverbal body language that either shows, oh no, that isn't the right guy, or that is the right guy. And, you know, I think if the police were better trained and there were some other mechanisms put into place to protect against those things, you'd have fewer false identifications. But the reality is the police have been doing it this way for a very long time, and there's a lot of resistance to changing the way they do it.
Right, right. And I think Molly brings up a good point that it's not necessarily malicious action on the part of police or the part of eyewitnesses that leads to these wrongful convictions. A lot of this process is a natural psychological process that has to do with how memories are created and how they're retained and how they're recalled. So something that science is really discovering now about how memories are formed in the brain is that as soon as we remember or we experience something, we filter our perceptions. And that original perception is stored in the short-term memory. Then it immediately starts to deteriorate as soon as we create that memory. And then when it's stored in the long-term memory, it's upon recall that we actually reconstruct, we rebuild the memory. And every time that we recall something, if we sort of think, oh wait, was that a red shirt or a green shirt? If we change from the red to the green, that is the memory that will be restored in our memory bank.
Yeah.
So the more that a person is called upon to recall an event, the more chance there is for that event to actually change in their memory. So by the time a witness comes to the witness stand to testify, they're not necessarily lying. It doesn't have to do with them being malicious against the defendant, but it can just be that they've actually had a different memory implanted in their brains.
And that goes to that case that you were mentioning, the Jennifer Thompson case. Once she had picked Ronald Cotton out in the photo lineup, that was the face that was in her memory. And even though a few years later she was actually face-to-face with the man who actually did attack her, she was still seeing Ronald Cotton. She was not seeing the actual attacker.
And so tell us about that case. What happened?
Well, Jennifer Thompson was a student at North Carolina, and a man broke into her apartment. She was in bed asleep and was awakened by this man in the apartment. He raped her continuously for a couple of hours. And she finally convinced him that she would fix him a drink. And throughout this whole process, she was really trying to pay attention to his face, because in her words, if she survived, she wanted to be able to identify him and make sure that he didn't do it to anybody else ever again. So she convinced him to let her go into the kitchen, get him a drink, and when he allowed that, she escaped. As it turns out, there were a couple of other rapes later that night. And Jennifer tried to do the right thing, went to the police, gave a description.
And there was no DNA evidence?
Well, this was 1983.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it was many years before biological material could be tested except for blood type, which was really the only kind of evidence that would come in. But yeah, so it was years before that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was biological material that they were able to recover. They saved it, fortunately. But she was shown a photo lineup, and it had Ronald Cotton's picture in it, and she picked Ronald's picture out, and the detective who was administering the photo lineup, was also the lead detective, so he knew who their suspect was. And as both Asia and Molly mentioned earlier, he congratulated her. She was doing the right thing, and her thought process was, I've got it right. This is the man who raped me. They went to trial. She identified him in court as the man. Just like Molly said, that's powerful testimony. That's the man who attacked me. So Ronald was convicted, went to prison, was there for a couple years, and this other man came through. His name is Bobby Poole. He said, you know, you look just like me. You look familiar. Are you from, and I forget, was it Durham?
I think it was Durham.
Durham,
yeah.
North Carolina.
And they met in
they
prison?
They met in prison.
In prison. Bobby Poole was there on a rape charge.
Oh, another rape conviction. And so Ronald raised that in a post-conviction motion. He was granted a new trial. And at trial, Jennifer identified him again. Bobby Poole was brought in, and she was asked, do you recognize this man? No, Ronald Cotton is the one who raped me, and Ronald was convicted again. Years later, DNA testing was done on the biological material, and it turned out it excluded Ronald Cotton and included and was a match, as good a match as you can get, to Bobby Poole. And so Ronald was exonerated. Bobby Poole eventually pled to the rape of Jennifer Thompson. After he had raped Jennifer, he went on to rape several other women. And that's the problem that we run into. When you send the wrong person to prison, the true culprit is out there continuing to prey on society, and Bobby Poole is a perfect example of that.
And the Central Park jogger.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, the interesting thing, I think, about the, you know, the point that Asia made and, you know, that you get from the Jennifer Thompson story is that, you know, juries are really good at figuring out when people are lying. That's sort of what juries, I think, are excel at. And they're, I don't believe there's a better system for that. There's some magic that can happen in the jury room to sort of determine someone's credibility. But in a case like Ronald Cotton's trial, Jennifer Thompson believed 100% that she was telling the truth. She was telling the truth.
Yeah,
she
would have passed the lie detector test.
Absolutely, because she really believed that Ronald Cotton was the person who had assaulted her. And so jurors are left with very credible witnesses who were coming in and saying, in Jennifer Thompson's case, and in a lot of cases, I am 100% certain this is the person who did it. And so the real question is, how do you stop that from happening? Because once a witness, as Asia said, once a witness is locked in to that reality, that's their reality. That memory is the memory.
And so basically, I mean, here I am sitting at the table with the three of you criminal defense attorneys. How do you do it? I mean, do you have to basically rely on physical evidence or other? I mean, what do you do?
Well, I mean, there are lots of reforms that have happened in states like North Carolina, actually in response to the Ronald Cotton case, that certainly can reduce the number of inaccurate identifications. So, for example, and they're pretty easy fixes in a lot of ways. for example, the case agent who's working on the case should never be the person who administers the lineup. So what there should be is what's called double-blind administration of a lineup. So the witness doesn't know that the suspect is included in the lineup, and the person administering the lineup doesn't know, A, if there's a suspect in there, or B, who the suspect is. And so, you know, you reduce the number. What studies have shown is if you do things like that, you reduce the number, the sort of incident of you know, affirmation. You know, good job, witness, you've picked the right guy.
Right.
There are other things like making sure that fillers, you know, the non-suspect individuals who are put in lineups, really match the description of the suspect, not the person who's been arrested necessarily, but the actual description that was given by eyewitnesses.
So if the eyewitness said it was a blonde 6-foot-tall man, and you put in one blonde 6-foot-tall man and then three short little brown-haired guys.
Right, right.
That would...
Who's the witness going to pick? They're going to pick the blonde guy.
So even if it's the wrong guy.
Precisely. That's exactly right. And that's what the science tells us. You want to make sure that the comparators are as accurate as possible to the description of the suspect, so that there isn't picking the best one, which is often what you have in these misidentifications.
And you also want to make sure that the witness knows that the suspect may not be in the lineup.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That, you know, he or she doesn't have to pick someone. There's not, like, the suspect isn't actually necessarily going to be there. You also want to ask the witness for their certainty level, right? Are you 100% sure this is the person, or are you 50% sure, 30%? If you can get them to write out from the first time they identify this person how strong their identification is, that can help a lot in the future.
Yeah, there's an interesting point about that, actually, which is that, you know, one of the things the courts look at is how certain someone is when they're sort of evaluating the accuracy of an identification. But what the science tells us is the opposite, that if someone says, I'm 100% certain of something, it actually is a better indicator of unreliability than it is of reliability, it's counterintuitive.
Yeah, and then science might know that, but judges and juries might not.
They sure don't.
That's right.
Very interesting. We've talked about this crazy subject of eyewitness misidentification, but there's also some very important things also to talk about when we are discussing wrongful convictions. People who are in prison, who are innocent, who did not commit the crime that they were convicted of. And another one of those is questions of science and forensics. And this is a field that's complicated for a number of reasons. One of them is because it changes every day. Our science and forensics are improving. Every police department in the country has different access to good forensics and different funding for their forensics. And some of the science, as we talked about earlier with hair analysis, is not good science in the first place. Not to mention, not every case, as you've said, has physical evidence. Get us up to date on this whole question of science and forensics. Oh, the other thing is what judges and juries know. So even if the defense presents good science, the public may not really be up to speed on what that is. Lots going on.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. The National Academy of Sciences actually in 2009 issued a report that basically says all of the almost all of the forensic sciences that the court system and judicial system, criminal justice system has been relying on for decades, if not centuries, is not really science. DNA is the only science, true forensic science out there, because it can be validated, it can be repeated. So much of it is subjective. The microscopic hair comparison is taking two hairs and looking at it underneath the microscope and making a subjective conclusion. In almost all the sciences, forensic sciences are that way. Fingerprints.
Arson investigation.
Yeah.
Fingerprints?
Fingerprints, oh, yes. Yeah. That the system has relied upon for hundreds of years. Yeah, it's still important. It's still important in the investigative aspect of a case, but it's not a true science. It is subjective.
Fingerprints are subjective?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Really?
Well, there's anything that involves the type of analysis that goes into things like fingerprint analysis or even DNA analysis, where there's sort of a human component.
Well, maybe because also, I mean, if you have somebody's fingerprint and then on a glass you have an absolutely whole, perfect fingerprint, but probably a lot of the time you have imperfect evidence.
Yeah, and even just the very basic, the foundations of fingerprint evidence have never, as Gordon said, have never really been scientifically validated. I mean, it's now a science that's over 100 years old. It's been regularly admitted into court, but there haven't been the sort of validation studies that you would have now for any sort of scientific method. And so, I mean, I know it's sort of shocking. Judges don't like to hear it because they've been admitting this evidence for literally over a century. But that is the reality of it.
What about things like, again, I mean, I apologize that my frame of reference is crime dramas on TV and crime novels and so on. But that's what we know. That's mm-hmm. what we, the public, know. But, I mean, you know, on the bottom of the criminal's shoe was dirt from a certain place. They're all nodding in a sort of like, oh God, rolling your eyes kind of way. No?
Well, I mean, it just depends. If there's something unique about, you know, the makeup of dirt, for example, a dirt sample. But generally, that type of evidence it's not what you read about in novels or see on TV. It's just very hard for, it's like microscopic hair analysis. I mean, there's a high level of subjectivity that goes into that analysis generally. And anytime there's a high level of subjectivity from a technician going into it, you know, there's some question about the validity of the results. The other issue is, I think people have this kind of, this conventional wisdom concept of, you know, technicians in these labs, you know, being highly trained with PhDs or masters in science and, you know, running around in their pristine laboratory with gorgeous white lab coats and, you know, flirting with each other over the samples or whatever. But,
right.
You know, the reality is many of the people who are doing these tests take, you know, short courses and become certified, but they're not scientists. They're not people who have years of training. They're not even sometimes people who have college degrees or any sort of advanced degree. So, you know, there is a real human component to forensic evidence and the analysis of forensic evidence that the report that Gordon referenced, the National Academies of Science report, really exposed that, you know, not all labs are created equal, and the results you get from the labs often depended on the level of basically sort of skill of the technicians.
And another sort of structural problem with the way forensic evidence is presented at trial that leads to wrongful convictions is that the state gets to present all of the forensic evidence as part of its case in chief for free. Or rather, it's not, these experts aren't paid for their testimony. Whereas the defense, if the defense wants to present an expert to rebut the state's interpretation of the evidence, that defense expert will have to be paid for their testimony. And when that comes to light, as it always does in front of the jury, then that seems like there's a hired hand on one side and there's the legitimate scientist on the other side. So that is a big hurdle for the defense to have to overcome in all of these cases if there is expert testimony presented on the defense side to try to show that the science wasn't conducted correctly or there was some kind of flaw.
Well, and I think there's an even more basic problem, which is that, you know, judges are under, you know, the rules of evidence and case law from the U.S. Supreme Court. judges are supposed to really be gatekeepers to keep out bad science. But unfortunately, what often happens is judges will allow sort of bad science to come in, bad technical or scientific evidence to come in, and their response to the defense's concerns about it is to say, oh, you can deal with it with a vigorous cross-examination, and the jury can weigh all these factors. And the problem with that is that what juries see that as is basically just sort of the adversarial process, rather than there are legitimate problems with this scientific or technical evidence that really means it's not reliable fundamentally. It's not just lawyer trickery saying, you know, like out of a few good men, you know, I mean, it's genuine concerns with the reliability of this type of evidence. And so, you know, I think judges, what I hope is that judges become more aggressive about their gatekeeper role and start excluding some of this evidence more aggressively. Yeah.
Right. And I mean, if you have somebody who needs a public defender who can't afford a high budget criminal defense attorney, you're not going to have your expert witnesses anyway.
Well, indigent defendants are entitled to having a full defense and funded by the government. So there
in theory,
is,
but in they don't always get it.
Right, they don't always get it, and it's a very you're exactly right. There's a very there are these larger problems with indigent defense where, you know, you have lawyers that are slammed with so many cases, and it's hard to prioritize cases, and it's hard to, you know, triage the cases that need to be triaged. And so that's exactly right. I mean, it's both a funding problem, which is true in states like all across the country, but certainly states like New Mexico. And it's also just a resources problem.
We're talking about wrongful convictions, people who go to prison for crimes that they have not committed. And another reason, besides improper forensics and improper eyewitness accounts, there are false confessions. We hear horror stories about coerced confessions. There are informants and snitches who give wrong information. What does that look like? What are some of those stories?
Well, false confessions is something that we have been working on in the innocence movement. I know that I have worked on cases where false confessions were given that eventually resulted in exonerations after years of investigation, years of incarceration. And when it comes to false confessions, the first question is always, why would somebody confess to something that they didn't do? And there's a lot of explanations for that. An example that I can give is that a young man was brought in as a suspect, interrogated for 3 or 4 hours, and the law enforcement officers were not getting what they wanted. And so they began to tighten the screws, if you will, and basically told him, we're going to arrest your girlfriend for harboring a fugitive. We're going to take her children away. Her children are going to become wards of the state. And it's because of you. And you're both going to go to prison. And so he confessed. He told them they had basically fed him information for 3 or 4 hours. He just repeated back to the detectives what they had told him.
What was the crime?
Murder. It was a murder case.
And this guy hadn't committed any murder?
No. It was robbery, murder of a convenience store clerk, and the detective was basically telling him, look, we know you didn't mean to do this. You had the gun pointed at her, and when the cash register drawer opened, you panicked, and it startled you, and you accidentally pulled the trigger and struck her in the forehead. So just tell us you did this, and we'll let you go home.
How did he get into that position?
Well, as often is the case, he was actually on work release. He was in jail for another misdemeanor, actually, and was known to live in the area. And so once this robbery happened and he didn't report back after his work release, they started looking for him and thinking, well, he's out. He's okay. Not coming back for a reason. He committed this murder, so he became the prime suspect right to the beginning of what Molly said at the beginning of the show. That's who they focused on and ignored other facts. Mm-hmm. And Edwin Chandler was his name, and Edwin finally said, I will take care of this in court. I did not do this, but I want to get this over with. I want to go home. He was 19 years old. They were threatening his girlfriend, and so he said, I did it. And he repeated back to them everything that they had fed him. And at trial, he got on the witness stand and said, I lied. I did not do this. I confessed to it just so I could get out of that room and I could take care of it here in court today. And he was convicted primarily on that false confession.
So what happened?
Well, he was he spent 17 years in prison, and that was one of the times that we were actually able to convince a detective that he was innocent. We shared information with him. He did his investigation and actually found a piece of evidence, a Schlitz malt liquor bottle of beer that was left on the counter that had been used as a purchase to get the cash register drawer opened. And he did fingerprint analysis. They had a new type of process, a laser type process that could separate the fingerprints. There were three sets of fingerprints on the bottle, and we had given him the name of the alternative suspect, and the top fingerprint was the alternative suspect.
And so this is a case where for 17 years that alternative suspect might be out robbing other convenience stores and killing other people.
He had already been in and out of prison a couple times by the time Evelyn was released. And the unfortunate thing in that particular case is that the police actually had the name of the actual killer the night of the crime. And it was a situation where first responders were from the sheriff's department and from the local police department, and they didn't share information. The deputy had the actual killer's name, and it never made it to the lead detective for the local police department. And we were fortunate to be able to find that piece of paper and talk to some other people, which convinced the detective that this guy was actually innocent. And he was actually, the detective was the lead advocate at the evidentiary hearing,
right,
testifying on behalf of that one.
You know, for every case like this that we're talking about on the radio, and for every case where somebody is actually exonerated, there have to be many times more cases where the person doesn't have, like, a detective advocate or doesn't have new evidence, but people are wrongfully convicted and really don't have a chance to get out.
Well, and that's particularly true in cases where there isn't physical evidence that can later exonerate someone. That's absolutely right. I mean, the numbers that we are basing, you know, the sort of, you know, how many people are actually in prison who are wrongfully convicted, it's really an estimate because we know about the DNA exonerations, but for all of those, there are cases where people, you know, probably were clearly convicted, but there isn't biological material to exonerate them ultimately.
Well, then there's the Adnan Syed case, the person who is talked about at great length in the podcast Serial, which millions of people across the United States have heard, and I listened to the whole thing, and one of the things that really struck me about that was after really two or three episodes, I started to get angry because it was clear that there was insufficient evidence to convict this guy, that the police had a pet theory that there was an informant whose story hadn't been examined at all, including by the people who made the podcast Serial. Mm-hmm. What's you guys' take on this?
Well, I think, you know, the Serial has been so interesting because, you know, of course, it's what we do every day. I mean, what we see every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that one of the things I was struck by is people's level of incredulity. How could the system break down this badly? And unfortunately, Adnan's case is not that unfamiliar. I mean, that happens, I would say, every day, many times a day in the criminal justice system.
And for those who don't know about this case, a young man, a high school student, was convicted for the murder of his ex-girlfriend in Baltimore in the late 1990s.
Late 90s, early 2000s. And I think one of the things that the other points I would make about that is we talked about this earlier, that, you know, the police find an attractive suspect and they find an attractive theory of the case, especially in homicides, very serious cases. There's a very strong, you know, desire and pressure for the police to solve the crime. And so, you know, Adnan's case sort of perfectly, I think, exemplified that, that they came up with a theory. And really what it hinged on was the motive. You know, who else had a motive to kill this young woman but her ex-boyfriend, who was an emotional guy who had this sort of tumultuous relationship and breakup with her? And so they sort of almost took the motive and then built backwards and trying to find evidence. And, of course, the evidence really, the only evidence against him, really, was the word of the informant, the snitch, Jay. And of course, looking at it now and listening to the podcast, I think a lot of people's reactions were, well, God, Jay's the one who knew everything. He knew where her body was. He knew, you know, these details about the murder. It's not Adnan who knew it, it's Jay, but Jay's the one who inculpated Adnan. And I see that phenomenon a lot in my practice, not just with post-conviction cases, but with actual going to trial cases, where the person who got to the police first, who became the informant, who said, I'm going to cooperate with you if you help me, the police will time and time again give them the benefit of the doubt, and they'll accept that version of the story and then, you know, shape the narrative around that narrative, and often, you know, to the detriment of the innocent person.
Now, are those people who were the snitches or informants, do they sometimes turn out to be the criminal?
Absolutely. Yeah. That happens in many, many, many cases. Either they're the person who actually did it, or they're the person who's far more responsible.
Or who knew who did it,
or his cousins who did it. Right, exactly.
Yeah, and we see in the cases that we look at, a lot of times stories will change to fit the narrative that law enforcement is now using, whether it's following up you know, with the snitch or another witness, whoever it might be. A lot of times we will see stories change so it fits with the state's theory.
And just to get back to the false confessions a little bit, the case that Gordon was talking about is one particular type of false confession, but there's been a lot of different research into all the various reasons why somebody might confess to something they didn't do. And some of those reasons have to do with coercion from the police, actual, you know, threats, or obviously physical force or whatever. But some of those reasons also have to do with the psychological makeup of the person who's confessing. So like Molly was talking about, they'll find an attractive suspect in especially these very charged, horrible, horrific cases. And sometimes that attractive suspect will be someone who is fragile or vulnerable psychologically, either through youth or through intellectual disability, mental illness. And that person will be more malleable to not really sticking to their innocence, right? So one of the things that police are allowed to do is they're allowed to lie to the suspect about what facts exist and what facts are known to the police. One of the big cases, the key cases in the innocence movement, I guess you could say, is the case of that young man who was convicted of killing both of his parents, right? And he was the man who called the police after he found his mother dead and his father dying. And when the police picked him up, they told him three false things about the evidence against him. First, they decided he was a suspect and they wanted to interrogate him. They told him that his mother was found with his hairs in her hand. They told him that his father had died in the hospital and that his father had told them he was the one who did it. So the third thing they told him is that they had passed him through a moisture detector and that they had been able to tell that he had showered before calling the police. None of these three things were true, but when he heard these things as like a 17 or 18-year-old boy who had just seen his parents dead and dying...
And he was completely traumatized.
Completely traumatized. And then he just realized that his father had died and had pointed to him as the murderer, so he thought. He confessed. He gave a full confession. And that confession is what led to his conviction.
And then what happened? What was the truth in that case?
The truth in that case, did they ever find the actual killer?
I don't think that they found the actual killer. He was ultimately exonerated, I think. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I mean, I had a case here in northern New Mexico years ago, back when I was a public defender, where the police told my client that his DNA had been found on a young girl's underwear, which was a complete lie. There was no biological material. And my client, who was intellectually disabled, ended up confessing to an assault that may not have actually even happened, but certainly it wasn't him who did it, if it did. And, you know, there are lots of, I think people are surprised to hear that the police can lie and manipulate during interrogations in that way. And, you know, a lot of, I would say, sort of neutral bodies like the American Psychological Association, American Psychiatric Association, a lot of criminal justice organizations, really one of their suggestions about how to reform the system to prevent things like that from happening is to not allow the police to manipulate in that way. Because even people who are not intellectually disabled, it's if you're sitting there in an interrogation room and you're being told, the only way I can help you is if you tell me you did this, a lot of people, like Gordon said, will say it because there's this enormous pressure bearing down on them, and they believe that's the only way they can get out of it.
Another thing that I've learned from watching crime shows is if you're in a situation like that, shut up and say, I want a lawyer.
I wish they would all do
but
it.
But if you're innocent...
You don't do that.
You think, I don't have anything to hide. I will talk. I don't need a lawyer.
Yeah, in the same way that, you know, with eyewitness identification, that juries are good at telling if someone's lying, and so that doesn't help in the situation of a well-intentioned but wrong eyewitness, the Miranda warnings, you know, that the police are obligated to give before they interrogate someone in custody, those don't work on innocent people. Because, exactly right, innocent people want to be helpful. They don't have anything to hide. And so why would they invoke their right to counsel or their right to silence?
We've got just about a minute left, but I'd like each of you to just quickly tell us what you think could be done to make the system work better.
Well, for us in the line of work that we're in, we need to make sure that we preserve the evidence, you know, because these mistakes do happen. We need to be able to have access to it later on.
We need to make sure that public defender departments are fully funded and that public defenders have a manageable caseload so they can really work their cases.
The courts need to catch up to the science on things like eyewitness identification and junk science and false confessions.
Molly Schmidt-Nuwara is a criminal defense attorney, and she's vice president of the New Mexico Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. She's also an adjunct professor at UNM Law School, the Innocence and Justice Project Seminar. Gordon Braun is a research professor at UNM Law School, and he's supervisor of the Innocence and Justice Project. And Asia Oishi is staff attorney for the Innocence and Justice Project. I want to thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.